Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. Following recent declarations by Senators McCain and Cruz that Republicans should hunker down for the next 4 years and refuse to allow anyone Hillary Clinton nominates to sit on the Supreme Court, we'll begin with the rumors of war on the Supreme Court coming from Senate Republicans who apparently are prepared to let the judiciary wither and die as threats of a total blockade on any and all of Hillary Clinton's nominees to the Supreme Court gather momentum. Erwin Chemerinsky, the founding dean and professor of law at the University of California, Irvine School of Law, with a joint appointment in political science, joins us to discuss how the no hearings, no vote stance of the Republican Senate in holding up Judge Garland's nomination for over a year that is unprecedented in American history is now taking on an even more partisan and obstructionist tone. We will assess whether threatening a constitutional crisis to rile up Republicans will also motivate Democrats to vote in sufficient numbers to take the Senate away from Republican control. Then we'll examine the latest report from the World Wildlife Fund's Living Planet Index that shows vertebrate populations are set to decline by 67% from 1970 levels, and unless urgent action is taken to reduce human impact, we are on track to lose two-thirds of wild animals on the planet by 2020. Stuart Pym, a professor of conservation ecology at Duke University, who is a world leader in the study of present-day extinctions and what can be done to prevent them, joins us. With just 15% left of the natural world that is protected, we will discuss how to stop the destruction of wild areas for farming and logging and reverse the impact of unsustainable fishing. Then finally, we will speak with Helmut Norpoth, a professor of political science at Stony Brook University, whose research includes electoral behavior, public opinion, and electoral forecasting. He has developed a model that has accurately predicted the winner of the popular vote in presidential elections that, applied retroactively, goes back to 1912. We will discuss his prediction of a Trump win back in February and why he is sticking by that prediction today, in spite of all the polls that favor a Hillary Clinton win. And joining us now is Erwin Chemerinsky, the founding dean and professor of law at the University of California, Irvine School of Law, with a joint appointment in political science. He frequently argues cases before the highest courts, including the Supreme Court, and his books include Interpreting the Constitution, Constitutional Law, Principles and Policies, Enhancing Government, Federalism for the 21st Century, The Conservative Assault on the Constitution, and his latest book is The Case Against the Supreme Court. Welcome to Background Briefing, Erwin Chemerinsky.
It's always a pleasure to talk with you.
Well, thank you, Erwin. And it looks as though there's almost a declaration of war against the Supreme Court in the sense that there is this movement afoot, starting with Senator John McCain saying that the Republicans wouldn't approve any nominee coming from Hillary Clinton. That's been joined now by Senator Ted Cruz. And there's some dissent within the Republican ranks. Senator Flake is saying that this is against the Constitution. But initially, what it looks like, they're certainly going to basically play hardball on the current vacancy with Judge Merrick Garland sort of twisting in the wind. But we don't know whether this is going to continue through the entire 4 years. So I find it extraordinary that, in effect, what the Republicans are saying now, what Mitch McConnell has said for some time, in effect says that a president is only entitled to a three-year term. On his fourth-year term, he doesn't have the rights and responsibilities of a president in terms of the Supreme Court. Now they're extending that to saying that the new president doesn't even have those rights for an entire four-year term. So I find it extraordinary, and I don't understand how anybody can take this sort of reinterpretation of the Constitution seriously.
It's unprecedented, and it's outrageous. All through American history, even when the President and the Senate were controlled by different political parties, still Supreme Court justices were nominated and confirmed. Over the course of American history, there have been 24 times which a president has nominated a Supreme Court justice in the last year of his term, and in 21 of the 24, the individual was confirmed, And in all 24, there was action taken. Never before have we seen what's occurred with regard to Merrick Garland. And never in history has the Senate said, we're not going to confirm anybody. Keep in mind, though, if the Democrats win the Senate on November 8th and Hillary Clinton is elected president, this issue goes away. She'll be able to get who she wants confirmed for the Supreme Court. But if she's president and the Republicans keep the Senate, they've made clear that they really are going to be obstructionist to an extreme with regard to filling vacancies on the Supreme Court.
But wouldn't that mean that Hillary Clinton has to get past the 60 threshold, that the Democrats have to win 60 seats in the Senate?
No, I don't think it means that, because I think that if Hillary Clinton is elected and there's a Democratic Senate and the Republicans tried to filibuster, the Democrats would simply change the rules of the Senate to eliminate the filibuster for Supreme Court nominations. Remember, a few years ago, the Democrats changed the rules with regard to the filibuster for lower court judges and also for the heads of agencies, cabinet positions. Never in history has a filibuster been used to block a Supreme Court nomination. I don't think that Senate Democrats would have any problem in eliminating it should the Republicans try to do that.
So is there any room for rationality? Is this something that's happening in the passions and the heat of the moment as we are about 2 weeks away from less than 2 weeks away now from the election? Is it possible that after the election, cooler heads will prevail?
I hope so, because otherwise what the Republicans are doing is setting the precedent that the next time there's a Republican president and there's a Democratic Senate, they won't confirm Supreme Court justices either. The Supreme Court doesn't exist at the pleasure of the Senate or the pleasure of Congress. Article 3 of the Constitution creates the Supreme Court. What the senators like McCain and Cruz are saying is that they can stop the Supreme Court from functioning. That's a blatant violation of separation of powers. It's unconstitutional for one branch of government to interfere with the functioning of another branch of government. To me, what this shows is there are so many places where the Constitution depends on the good faith of those of us who govern it. It depends on the good faith of Congress to pass a budget for the Supreme Court. What if Congress say we'll give no federal funds for the salary of Supreme Court justices? It's clearly unconstitutional. What if the Senate say we're not going to confirm Supreme Court justice ever again in the future? Clearly unconstitutional. We need the people to say that this is just unacceptable.
And again, I'm speaking with Erwin Chemerinsky, who's the founding dean and professor of law at the University of California, Irvine School of Law, with a joint appointment in political science. He frequently argues cases before the highest courts, including the Supreme Court, and his latest book is The Case Against the Supreme Court. Now, what you're talking about there, though, is the potential of the Supreme Court literally dying. And as it happens, the Cato Institute's Ilya Shapiro, in a column Wednesday in The Federalist, wrote, as a matter of constitutional law, the Senate is fully within its powers to let the Supreme Court die out, literally. So what's going on there? I mean, that's
nonsense. Article 3 of the Constitution says the judicial power of the United States shall be vested in the Supreme Court. If Congress couldn't do that, what if Congress then says, you know, we really don't like this president. We're not going to appropriate any money for the president's salary or any staff for the president. Could the Senate then extinguish the presidency as well? The Constitution requires that there be a president. The Constitution requires that there be a Supreme Court. And Congress has to take the actions, like passing a budget, like confirming judges, that's required for the branch to fill its duties. This country has been around for over 200 years. Never before has senators talked that way.
So what is Ilya Shapiro of the Cato Institute saying then when he says that the Constitution is completely silent on how the upper chamber, that's the Senate, provides its advice and consent on the president's nominees? What is the argument there?
Well, he's certainly right. What the Constitution says is the president shall nominate. President is required to, with the advice and consent of the Senate. I think both the President and the Senate are required to take action. Now, it doesn't say how the Senate will give advice and consent. The Constitution in so many places is just an outline, but we have over 200 years of history. Presidents nominate, the Senate either approves or rejects, and if the Senate rejects, the president can nominate somebody else. We've had countless instances where the president has been of one political party and the Senate has been of another. And always, both Democratic and Republican situations, the Senate has still been willing and able to confirm Supreme Court nominations. This is what's unprecedented for senators to say, or commentators like Ilya Speer say, we never have to confirm anybody. We can put the Supreme Court out of existence. That can't be right when the Constitution requires there be a Supreme Court.
So following John McCain's incendiary comments suggesting a total blockade of the Supreme Court in terms of anything Hillary Clinton would put forward as a nominee, and that was met by Senator Chuck Grassley, who is the chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee and obviously an important position. He said then, we can't just simply stonewall these hypothetical Clinton nominees. But this is the same Senator Grassley who's stonewalling Merrick Garland. So I'm not sure who you can believe here. And now you've got Ted Cruz joining in, saying, essentially declaring war on any Clinton nominee, and even quoting Justice Breyer as saying there's no problem with having this current Supreme Court one short with eight justices. Now, let's start with that. Did Breyer ever say that?
I don't know if he did, but certainly other justices have been clear in saying that there is a problem. And let me try to explain why. One of the most important functions of the Supreme Court is to make sure that the Constitution and federal laws mean the same thing in every part of the country. It's not fair if a constitutional provision or a federal statutory provision means something in one place in the country and something different elsewhere. And so the Supreme Court sees among its highest priorities to resolve conflicts in the law among the circuits and the states. But what if the same law is interpreted differently in varying parts of the country, and the Supreme Court then splits 4-4, as it did a number of times last year? Then we're left with the same law meaning different things in varying parts of the country. The Supreme Court can't play its role of making sure that federal law is uniform when it's only got eight justices.
So when the Chief Justice, John Roberts, was confirmed, he made the famous analogy of being the umpire, just calling balls and strikes. And he has also intervened a couple of times on issues involving the judiciary with this enormous backlog of judges, which he's complained about. He's nominally the head of the judiciary, surely. So as such, is he doing his duty as the head of the judiciary in basically not speaking out for the fact that we have a broken Supreme Court?
I think he's made a political decision not to speak out with regard to Merrick Garland. I think the interesting question will be, if Hillary Clinton wins and there's a Republican Senate and they continue to block Supreme Court nominees, when will John Roberts then choose to speak up? But again, all of this is hypothetical. It all depends on having Hillary Clinton win and there being a Republican Senate. If there's a Democratic Senate, this issue is going to go away. Even if Hillary Clinton wins in the Republican Senate, if she nominates someone like Merrick Garland, who's quite moderate, I still believe that there's going to be enough Republican senators to go along. I don't think here John McCain and Ted Cruz speak for all the Republican senators. I think senators like Hatch and Grassley may very well say, we can't block everybody. So I wouldn't assume that just because McCain and Cruz say this, and Ilya Shapiro says it's a good idea, but that's what a Republican Senate would do.
Well, but politically speaking, does this give impetus to potential Democratic voters? I mean, one of the arguments always, whenever a political party fails to make a strong case, they always say, well, we can't possibly let the other party win because of their appointees to the Supreme Court. It does seem that on the Republican side, there's more passion in that regard, that Republicans actually feel stronger about the Supreme Court. And Donald Trump has been, you know, pressing that button. Is it time for Hillary Clinton to press that button, too, and not just to say we've got to win over the Senate? We've got to win over the Senate by a sufficient margin to stop this insanity.
Absolutely. I think that the Supreme Court is as important as any issue in the November 8th presidential election. The next president is likely to have as many as 4 vacancies to fill on the court. The average age at which a justice has left the bench is 78 years old. There are 3 justices right now, 78 or older, Justice Ginsburg, Kennedy, and Breyer, and there is a vacancy to fill. What happens with these 4 seats on the court is going to determine every issue of constitutional law, abortion rights, campaign finance, guns, racial issues, death penalty, separation of church and state. And so I'm disappointed that there hasn't been more emphasis on the significance of this election with regard to the composition of the Supreme Court. What the Supreme Court does affects all of us, often in the most important and intimate aspects of our lives.
Well, but Hillary Clinton's already had problems with Bernie's voters. They're a little churlish, and they're not necessarily, the millennials aren't necessarily flocking to her banner. She's not really had a strong narrative about why you should vote for her, except her message is stronger together. Everybody knows what Donald Trump's motto is or message. It's make America great again and build a wall. But lately, she has at least gotten behind the idea that Trump would be a catastrophe for both the country and the world, and we don't want his finger near the nuclear button. Is it possible that she can – would you have a suggestion for Owen to get the millennials out in terms of what you just told us, how important this is for their future, for the future of the millennials, that this Supreme Court, this election, it's not just Clinton we're talking about, it's mostly getting the Democrats to control the Senate to a degree that the Republicans can't sabotage any nominees in the future, and therefore we'll have a dysfunctional Supreme Court?
I've long believed that Hillary Clinton needs to focus on what she stands for more than just what's abhorrent about Donald Trump. And one of the things she stands for is a Supreme Court, and she talked about this at the last debate, that will protect women's right to choose, that will allow reasonable regulation of guns, that will overrule Citizens United and try to deal with the evils of huge amounts of money in the context of election campaigns. And I would hope that over the next 10 days before the election, that she, the candidates for the Senate, and there's so many close Senate races right now that are going to be determinative. Indiana is still very close. Pennsylvania, New Hampshire, North Carolina, Nevada. It's what happens in these races that's going to determine who Hillary Clinton can put on the Supreme Court and maybe even whether anyone gets confirmed for the Supreme Court.
Well, just in closing, do you think that Ted Cruz and John McCain are actually helping in that regard?
I think that they're saying something that will help fire up part of the Republican base. I hope that Democratic voters are hearing the message and knowing it's why it's so important that Democrats take not just the presidency, but also control of the Senate.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Owen Chemerinsky.
Anytime. My pleasure.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Owen Chemerinsky, who's the founding dean and professor of law at the University of California, Irvine School of Law, with a joint appointment in political science. He frequently argues cases before the highest courts, including the Supreme Court, and his latest book is The Case Against the Supreme Court. We're going to take a brief station break and back examining the latest report from the World Wildlife Fund that shows we are on track to lose 2/3 of wild animals on the planet by 2020.
Stop being at first, 'cause here comes the judge. Don't nobody budge, 'cause here comes the judge. Judge Shawty is presiding today, and he don't take no stuff from nobody, no kind of way. Hey boy, take off that hat. Where do you think you're at? I know where you.
In this sacred land, it has seen many hands. It has wealth and gold, yet it is fragile and old. And now the greedy souls just don't care to know all the changes it will confirm. So speak out loud of the things you are proud. And if you love this coast, then keep it clean as it holds. 'Cause the way that it shines may just dwindle with time, with the changes it will confirm.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Stuart Pym, a professor of conservation ecology at Duke University, a world leader in the study of present-day extinctions and what can be done to prevent them. His commitment to science and policy has led to his testimony to both House and Senate committees on the reauthorization of the Endangered Species Act. Welcome to Background Briefing, Stuart Pym.
Thank you so much.
And the World Wildlife Fund have just released a report, the Living Planet Index, which shows that we are on track to lose two-thirds of wild animals by 2020. That is an appalling thought, and I take it this is largely true, is it not? I mean, there may go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, it's broadly true that we are doing bad things to the planet. Where I'm critical is that I don't think it's really helpful to try and lump everything we're doing to the oceans, everything we're doing to the land, to the rivers, to lakes, everything that we're doing in Africa and North America and Australia and Asia, you know, into one single number. Because I think by doing that, you lose a lot of the insight into what's going on. You lose where the good news is, where the terrible news is. And it's a bit of a mixture of all of those things.
So would you prefer the index to be sort of categorized in terms of what is the most urgent thing to address in terms of impending extinction of a particular species and then go down the list towards, you know, the good news, starting with the worst?
Yeah, I mean, let's take my particular field is extinctions and what we can do to prevent them. And there's no question that we are driving species to extinction at probably 1,000 times the rate that they would go naturally. And that's very alarming because extinction is irreversible. We can't bring species back. But, you know, if you then step back and look at that, if you look at our own country, if you look at what we've done in the United States with the Endangered Species Act, once a species gets put on the list of species that are in danger of extinction, they have a really good chance of surviving. It's not all gloom and doom. There are millions of very competent people around the world who are doing a good job. We're setting aside more of the Earth's surface in national parks and protected areas. Quite recently, President Obama set aside a very large piece of the Pacific Ocean as a protected area. I think you've got to have a little bit more detail beyond that single number before you can get into insights that are meaningful.
Well, I suppose in terms of getting people motivated to do something, and when you say the extinction rates are happening 1,000 times faster than they would normally be happening in nature undisturbed, that in itself is almost an indictment of the human species. So it would seem to me that we don't want to reinforce despair on the one hand, but we also, you know, want to sort of get people to step up because...
I totally agree. I mean, I think it's a very fine line, and I would rather the report have sort of greater nuance in terms of showing where there are really dire situations and where there are, you know, where there's room for hope. There definitely is room for hope, and I think it's useful to contrast the success with the failures so that people can learn the difference. I mean, if you look at the raw number, you know, that we've lost 60% of wildlife since 1970, you know, even with a little bit of arithmetic expertise, you'd say, well, another 25 years, there isn't going to be anything left. And that's not true. And I think it's unfortunate that it's been portrayed in these very dire terms. There are places where it's dire, there are places where we've been very successful.
And again, I'm speaking with Stuart Pym, who's a professor of conservation ecology at Duke University. He's a world leader in the study of present-day extinctions and what can be done to prevent them. And his commitment to science and policy has led to his testimony to both House and Senate committees on the reauthorization of the Endangered Species Act. But since this is your specialty, Stuart Pym, studying extinctions, What is the conclusion here in the broadest sense? I mean, it's almost as though there's some imperative on the part of human beings to, you know, conquer the earth, if you will, at the expense of biodiversity and other living things. What is this compulsion that drives extinction, if indeed it is it just human activity in the broadest sense, or is there some psychological underlying reason why we as a species threaten others?
Well, you know, obviously we have gone forth and multiplied and multiplied and multiplied, so there are now in excess of 7 billion of us on the planet. Even worse than that is that we seem to have unlimited aspirations. We want to do more and more and more things and have more and more things. And that is something that I think we need to look at very, very carefully. Because within that, there are choices that we make. You know, what I spend my time doing is working out solutions with people who live in very poor places, surrounded by extraordinary beauty and the species that live there. And I try to work with them to find solutions where, you know, they can have their biodiversity and eat too. And there are a lot of things we can do. We can tread a lot more lightly on the landscape than we have. You know, so much of tropical deforestation is not driven by a need to feed people. It's often driven by carelessness and stupidity, and sometimes, yes, greed. There are a lot of things we have to do. You know, if you're going to eat fish, you can eat sustainably harvested fish. You can make choices as near as the nearest supermarket.
But, for example, if you go to the nearest supermarket, a lot of the products you buy have palm oil in them. And
exactly so.
The deforestation in Indonesia is absolutely criminal, is it not?
It is. It's horrendous. And, you know, we don't need palm oil. We can get through life without palm oil. We could use other kinds of oils. That's not something that, you know, not something we need. I don't think our lives would be any poorer if we decided that we weren't going to, you know, chop down the forests of Sumatra and Borneo to grow oil palm.
So is there for education? I mean, I know it's a loose term, but it would seem to me that I'm always never understood why it is, for example, that in China there are so many peculiar obsessions about aphrodisiacs coming from bears and stuff like that, and shark's fins, you name it. And I don't know whether it's fair to blame the Chinese for their cultural proclivities, but, you know, in that regard, you would think that maybe there's some hope that people could be educated. One, that maybe these things don't work, and the idea of wiping out bears in order to some guy to get some, you know, something he can get from Viagra doesn't make a lot of sense to me. So that
doesn't make any sense to me too. So the question is, what do we do about that? I now spend a month or two every year in China. It's an extraordinary country. It's changing at a breathtaking pace. And one of the obvious things that's happening in China is more and more Chinese are beginning to travel and seeing their own wonderful national parks in the west of China, in Yunnan and Sichuan. But also, after I was in China this year, I was in Africa. Chinese are beginning to become international tourists. Lots of Chinese are going to Africa. And when they do so, they see elephants and they see rhinos and they see and lions. And that begins to affect a change where more and more middle-class Chinese realize that, you know, it's not a good idea if elephants end up as, or elephant ivory ends up as trinkets. And that's, I think, a very powerful way in which education happens. People see the world, they see the problems, and that kind of increasing peer pressure you know, will encourage them not to, you know, not to destroy species. And, you know, and there are models here in our own country. I mean, if, you know, I was in New York 2 days ago. One no longer sees young women walking down the street wearing leopard skin coats. If anyone were to do that, they would be excoriated. We just don't put fur coats of wild animals on people anymore. Would change their attitudes. And I think that kind of change can happen. And once it happens, it can happen very quickly indeed.
Of course, once though haunted by, I don't know whether you've seen these recent pictures of the loneliest polar bear stuck in a little small glass cage in a shopping mall in China. So
it's
a shocking...
I mean, I think we don't need to, you know, we don't need to beat up on the Chinese.
No.
The Chinese are doing things that we don't approve of, but, you know, we did things 30 years ago that we want to approve of now. The important thing is that we learn. I mean, you know, the reason that polar bears are threatened is because the poles are melting because of our enormous consumption of fossil fuels. Well, there's a lot of things we can do. We can develop renewable energy portfolios. So an ever increasing fraction of our energy comes from renewable resources like wind and solar. You know, there are, you know, we are a very, very smart species. There's a lot of things we can do if we put our minds to it. And I think what these studies that show how bad the planet or how bad the planet's biodiversity is faring, you know, are a warning cry to tell us that we can't do business as usual and we've got to get smart and we've got to find some solutions.
So given that we are the biggest consumers of all of the above, just about, you know, energy in particular that's causing the polar ice caps to melt and endangering the polar bears and the planet in general, if we've got the clout as consumers, is it just a case of organization? I mean, for example, boycotting palm oil, would go a long way probably to saving the rainforests in Indonesia. Is that, I don't get, there's no coordinated message. I mean, here we have this alarming report from the World Wildlife Fund that we're on track to lose 2/3 of the wild animals on the planet by 2020. But I don't see the action plan that should come with this because, again, you know, you don't want to reinforce despair. You want to motivate people to solve this problem before it's
absolutely
too late.
I mean, there is not one solution that fits all. There's a lot of individual things that we can do, and there are practical things that those of us who are doing conservation for a living that can do. I run a small conservation group called Saving Species. We raise money for conservation groups in the places where species are at greatest risk of extinction in Colombia and Ecuador and Brazil and Madagascar and places like that. We work with local communities. We help those communities reforest their landscapes. When you deforest an area on a steep mountain slope like Colombia, when it rains, the soils wash away. You know, we can work with local people and restore the landscape. We can heal the planet. There are a lot of projects like that where very competent people engage local communities and make a difference. So we can do that internationally. We can be smarter consumers. We can realize that what we do has, you know, the actions that we take have international consequences. I think it's a matter of sort of waking up and just changing our lifestyles and thinking a little bit about how we should be behaving.
Well, years ago, I spoke to an ecologist at the University of Wisconsin, and I was told that in terms of optimum biodiversity for the planet, we should have about 1 billion people on the planet. And we have, as you pointed out, we have about over 7 billion. So how do we deal with that if that's indeed the main driver, that just the sheer numbers are what are endangering the planet? How is that approached? I know zero population and other efforts have floundered in the past.
Well, if you look at the trajectory of human population growth, it is beginning to slow. You know, we wish it was slowing rather longer ago than it is. But it's beginning to slow, and the biggest lever that we have to pull is educating women. And if you educate women, they do not want to have, you know, very large numbers of children and die in childbirth when they're in their 20s, which is the sort of fate of a typical woman living in a country like Mali in Africa. So educating women is altogether a good thing, and when you do that, it brings the population growth rate down. Now, that isn't going to solve the fact that we already have so many people. So what we have to do is we have to be smart in terms of looking after what we have. And there are many things we can do. I mean, in the oceans, we've eliminated sharks from most of the world's oceans. You know, frankly, I think we can get on in life without shark fin soup. And there's a lot of things that we can do without that really don't enrich our lives and yet would make the planet a lot better place. And so I think it's those kinds of solutions, those kind of the things that we can do. I mean, you know, once upon a time, there was a thriving whale industry off New England, off California. Now there's an even more thriving whale industry where people go out with their cameras, you know, and photograph the whales that swim past the California coast twice a year. There are ways of turning things around so that we can begin to enjoy the wonderful planet that we have.
Well, when you say, though, Stuart Pym, that we have to educate women, surely we should educate men who demand sex from women that's unprotected.
Well, there are many cultural things there, but even a modest amount of education for a woman tends quite rapidly to lead to a birth rate. Now, of course, there are many countries where the women don't have that choice. But by and large, as countries develop, as people become better educated, the birth rates go down, and we're going to need to make that happen, because clearly, I mean, you simply cannot have unlimited human population growth without causing massive environmental harm.
But if we have to wait for the third world to catch up to the first world in order for people to have fewer families, the trappings of the first world are all about massive consumption and the things that we all have that the have-nots want. So isn't this a case of the haves need to have less and the have-nots need to have more?
Yeah, I mean, clearly there are important issues of equity. I spend a lot of my life, I mean, very roughly 3 billion people live on less than a few dollars a day. And when you're that poor, you don't have electricity, you don't have access to safe water, your food supply is insecure, and you don't have access to antibiotics when you get ill. Clearly, you know, there is a pressing moral concern that we are not treating people around the world equitably. The actual implementation of that is outside my area of expertise. But working in poor local communities, I realize there's a lot of things we do. I work in projects where we help local communities build schools. People are thrilled to have schools, and we educate the kids in the schools. They become guides to people who want to come and visit the nearby national park. There are ways of making a huge amount of difference with what is essentially, you know, kindness and a strong sense of moral obligation towards people who are poorer than ourselves.
Well, just in closing, should we all be vegetarians?
Well, you know, I'm not a vegetarian. I don't eat a lot of meat. I eat rather more fish than meat. I think very carefully about what I eat. I just think very carefully about how I tread on, you know, how I tread on the landscape. I think many people choose to be vegetarians, and good for them. But I think whatever we do, we want to be thinking about what the impact of that is going to be on our planet.
Well, Stuart Pym, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you for having me on the program. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And again, I've been speaking with Stuart Pym, who's a professor of conservation ecology at Duke University. He's a world leader in the study of present-day extinctions and what can be done to prevent them. And his commitment to science and policy has led to his testimony to both House and Senate committees on the reauthorization of the Endangered Species Act. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking to a prediction that our guest is sticking by, that Donald Trump will win the presidential election.
So excuse me, Mr. But I'm a Mr. Too, and you're giving Mr. bad name, Mr. Like You. So I'm taking the Mr. from out in front of your name, 'cause it's Mr. Like You that puts the rest of us to shame. It's a Mr. Like.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Helmut Norporth, who is a professor of political science at Stony Brook University, whose research includes electoral behavior, public opinion, wartime elections, economic voting, electoral realignment, and electoral forecasting. He's the co-author of The American Voter Revisited and the author of the forthcoming book, Commander-in-Chief, Franklin Roosevelt and the American People. Welcome to Background Briefing, Helmut Norporth.
Thank you.
And you have a system of predicting the outcomes of elections that has been accurate, I think, what, since the 1990s?
Yeah, I've done this for the first time in 96. The basic model is very much the same. I've modified it a little bit over the years, but it has been picking the winner of the popular vote correctly in all elections since that time, 96, and including 2012.
But in 2000, though, you predicted Al Gore, right?
Yes, that's why I'm saying I predicted the popular vote winner, and I couldn't handle some of the problems that they had in Florida in getting the vote straight. So I
right. Well, I'm not going to
have a handle on that.
I'm not going to hold you responsible for
that.
So this, of course, goes against the conventional wisdom at the moment, where I think in pretty much all polls, Donald Trump is behind.
Yes.
So why are you confident that you're going to be right this time?
Well, I think my confidence largely based on the track record of the model that I've built. It's not a model that uses opinion polls, and so I'm not too worried. Although I guess it would be more reassuring if the polls also showed the same result. But it is a different approach to election forecasting, sort of more an analytic approach that takes into account what happens in real elections, the outcome of elections, and in particular primary elections, which I think is a much overlooked predictor of what's happening in November.
So you think that because Trump did so well in the primaries, that's an indicator? I mean,
yes.
First of
yes,
all,
yes, absolutely. I mean, I can track that back for about 100 years to 1912, and the pattern that I see is that the nominee, the major party nominee, who does better in the primary of his or her party, is going to be the winner in the election in November.
Well, but wasn't this year's primary on the Republican side unusual with so many candidates? Donald Trump, even though he won, he got a small percentage of the overall vote because it was split so many ways. So is that a factor that you've taken into account?
Well, it could be. I mean, I think if my forecast this time turns out to be wrong, I would probably have to look at that and see what difference it makes that you have a large field and that you can win a few of these contests with a pretty small vote. But it's really not that unusual. If you look, for example, at Jimmy Carter in 1976, he would win the early primaries by something like 29-30%. And then he built up a lot of momentum, and he won bigger and bigger margins. And then in the end, he got the nomination and won the election. So if you're in the out party, you usually have quite a competition going on. It's not unusual to have, about five or six really serious contenders. With Trump, there were a few more, but I think some of them really were never much in the race. I mean, he had to sort of probably fight against maybe three or four serious opponents, and that would not be too unusual.
But in Jimmy Carter's win, and again, I think he can also, this applies to Barack Obama's win in 2008, mm-hmm. Jimmy Carter was coming off the Watergate, and then Nixon, of course, chose Gerald Ford as his vice president, mm-hmm. and he was still, to some extent, tainted, even though he had nothing to do with Watergate. I think that was a big factor. And then in 2008, clearly the crash of the economy made it impossible for McCain. So what about events like that? And in this year, of course, mm-hmm. you might add to that list that the emergent of all these scandals about Donald Trump's attitude and behavior towards women.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, certainly, I mean, that's a problem for him. But again, I mean, to look for a parallel, it's not unlike what Bill Clinton went through in '92. He was dogged by these kind of sex scandals, and he overcame that. He won. So maybe, that kind of a problem has been sort of settled with Bill Clinton making it anyway.
And again, I'm speaking with Helmut Norpoth, who is a professor of political science at Stony Brook University, whose research includes electoral behavior, public opinion, wartime elections, economic voting, electoral realignment, and electoral forecasting. And he's the co-author of The American Voter Revisited and the author of the forthcoming book, Commander-in-Chief, Franklin Roosevelt and the American People. And so your prediction system, just to remind the audience, has been correct in all elections since 1996?
Yes, that's correct. In terms of the popular vote.
In terms of the popular vote.
That modification, yes.
Mm-hmm. And you can even extend it out to having correctly predicted the winner of every presidential election since 1912. That's kind of a retroactive.
Yeah, retroactive. If I took the view that I applied the model as if some of these old elections were still happening, then the model would make a prediction that would be correct for all the election since 1912 except 1960.
Right, and you stand by it. You still think that there's going to be a surprise that Trump's going to win the popular vote.
Well, it's going to be a surprise for people who are fixated on the polls right now. Yes.
So could you have a situation, though, since your prediction model deals with the popular vote, could you have a situation, because Hillary Clinton appears to have a substantial advantage in the Electoral College, could we have a situation where Hillary Clinton wins the Electoral College and Donald Trump wins the popular vote?
Well, it would have to be a very close one. I mean, as you said, we had it in 2000, in which Al Gore won by probably a half a percentage point lead over Bush. If it's that close, it could happen. But the lead that I'm projecting for Donald Trump, which is sounding ludicrous to some people, 52.5% of the popular vote, of the two-party popular vote against Hillary was 47.5%. With that kind of a spread, that kind of a lead, I think it would be very, very unlikely, almost impossible, that this could happen.
And this, in your model, what about the third parties, third and fourth? That's the Libertarian and the Greens. Do they come into it?
I've looked at some elections where I've made forecasts in which we had substantial third-party votes. I think, and as far as I'm concerned, the last one would be 96. Perot got something like 10%. And then retroactively before that, in 92, he got close to 20. And then, he had George Wallace in 68. In any of these elections in which there were substantial third-party candidates, I don't had a problem in making the prediction. So I've never had an election which a third party candidate would have ruined it and turned it upside down. So that's out of my experience.
But still, by the numbers that you gave us, 54 to 48, that's still a narrow margin. Gary Johnson would I think he's even at 5%, isn't he, which is bigger than that margin.
Yes, yes. Well, it would depend, I mean, whether the people who are voting for him, if he had not been a candidate, would shift dramatically to one candidate over the other. And trust anything in the polling, it looks that some of the people who lean toward somebody like him would maybe split sort of 50-50 or just slightly in favor of one or the other, and maybe they wouldn't even vote at all. I mean, that's always something people don't think about, that if you take the third party candidates out of the mix, some of the voters that are attracted to them might just not turn out if they weren't on the ballot.
So, I did interview a while back Alan Lichtman at the American mm-hmm. University, and I'm sure you know his work.
Yeah, I know him. Yeah, yeah. He's been a part of our sort of forecasting clique that sometimes gets together and make forecasts, and we compare our predictions. Yes, I know him. I've seen this. 13 keys, right.
Right, and he predicted a Trump win, but for different reasons, I think, than your calculations, which are based upon primaries, etc. His calculation from what the interview that I did with him relatively recently more or less suggested that this just happens to be a change year, that there's mm-hmm. a certain dynamic that gets in play in American politics
right.
where the public are just, mm-hmm. you know, particularly after a two-term presidency, they just want change. And in this case, you've mm-hmm. got this populist uprising going on the left with Bernie Sanders and on the right with Donald Trump, mm-hmm. which is clearly a rejection of politics as usual. Mm-hmm. So is that something that you've factored in?
Yeah, we certainly agree with that. And in fact, I have a predictor that captures that. I call it the swing of the pendulum, and I model it by sort of a cyclical model of presidential elections. So on that score, one of his keys would be my key. So, and I think in terms of primaries, he also has something like a primary key. So, we sort of have maybe two keys in common, but that's it for me. I mean, he has 11 others, and that's just it for me. But on those two things, I think we probably would agree that based on that, changes in the air, and so Donald Trump, as a candidate of a party that's out of government, would have a shot.
Right, but the point I wanted to make was that this populist explosion that's going on, this discontent, this rejection of the elites that's mm-hmm. happening on both the right and the left, mm-hmm. that is a relatively new phenomenon. It's not unheard of in our history, but mm-hmm. it seems to be particularly acute at this moment. So, mm-hmm. and to my mind, that's not about a swinging pendulum. That's mm-hmm. about a sudden mm-hmm. sort of outburst, if you will, of political passions that don't fit into the models that we have. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, let's face it. You know, Bernie Sanders, who's an avowed democratic socialist, gave Hillary Clinton a good run for her money.
Right.
And he's not even a Democrat. And it's hard to see what kind of a Republican Donald Trump is. He's certainly causing a lot of his fellow Republicans heartburn. So you've mm-hmm, got, mm-hmm. you know,
sure.
the point
mm-hmm.
I'm trying to make is obvious, you know, that we don't.
But of course, I mean, the fact that you have that upheaval in the Democratic Party as well, I mean, raises the question about what are these people going to do who want to change with Bernie Sanders, didn't get the change candidate. They might. Some of them just might go for the other change candidate. I mean, sometimes change is more important than maybe the direction of change that you have in mind. You just want somebody else, and so some people, I mean, are speculating whether maybe at least some portion of Bernie Sanders voters are maybe finding their way to Trump, or just not vote for Hillary either. So either way, I think it would help Trump.
So if Hillary Clinton is so far ahead in so many polls mm-hmm. at the moment, there's just no question about it. And even the Clinton campaign is now warning its supporters not to be too complacent, because clearly she's not run a very clear campaign in the way mm-hmm. that Donald Trump, you know exactly what he stands for. He's going to make America great again, mm-hmm. and he's going to build a wall. Mm-hmm. Hillary Clinton hasn't had a clear slogan,
right.
except Stronger Together. Mm-hmm. But she sort of found, I think, a clearer direction and platform in basically saying that Donald Trump would be a catastrophe both domestically mm-hmm. and internationally,
right.
and running commercials, questioning
right.
whether he should have his finger on the nuclear button. So mm-hmm. she's finally found a narrative. But mm-hmm. as the polls indicate that she has a comfortable lead, that narrative is undercut, surely, that, that the fear of Trump goes away, so the motive to vote for Hillary Clinton diminishes.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Is that something that's happening now in your calculations?
Well, I mean, I don't really have a way to factor that in. I mean, my measure of the candidate's strength is based on what they did in the primaries, and there's nothing I can add to it. No, I just the only thing I can sort of hope or expect is that whatever. Is captured at that point is going to translate into some advantage in the general as it has in the past, and how that exactly happens, I guess we'll have to figure out. And if Trump doesn't win, and if he goes down, Hillary wins big, then and clearly some of these calculations didn't materialize. I think what Donald Trump's problem is that he has to be able to reassure some voters, at least, that he can be trusted with a job, and he's still working on that. And if he doesn't, then maybe he's not going to make it.
But just in closing, though, do you think that Hillary Clinton would be wise not to she's virtually measuring the drapes in the White House now?
Well, she better not. I think, some candidates who did that, I think, fell on their face. So I think that she shouldn't be too comfortable about what the polls are showing, because some of these polls, many of these polls these days, if they're done by the telephone and what they have to try to do to figure out who's going to vote, I have a feeling sometimes they don't know what they're doing.
Well, we will... we'll get back to you.
yes. On, one way or the other.
On November the 9th. Okay?
Maybe not.
Right. Okay.
Maybe it's just a footnote.
Yeah. Well, I thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you very much for having me on. Really, really enjoyable talking to you about these issues. Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Helmut Norpoth, who is a professor of political science at Stony Brook University, whose research includes electoral behavior, public opinion, wartime elections, economic voting, electoral realignment and electoral forecasting. And he's the co-author of The American Voter Revisited and author of the forthcoming book, Commander-in-Chief, Franklin Roosevelt and the American People. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.